Mental Health Monday
on Radio City Talk
with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Radio City Talk.
Yeah, Mental Health Monday, we continue. And we've got a really great guest on the programme today who's got an incredible story to tell, and also somebody who has been nominated in the Merseyside Women of the Year Awards. Jess Gallier is our special guest today. Jess, great to see you. How are you?
Hi, Mick. I'm really well, thank you.
How are you? Yeah, good, thank you. Congratulations on your nomination.
Oh, thank you.
I think over the course of the next sort of half hour or so, people will get a sense about why you've been nominated. And also, I'll mention that people can vote for you.
Oh, absolutely.
As well, if they see fit. We're doing some more throughout the course of the week on the Merseyside Women of the Year, but you're the first one on.
We've had
a previous winner already on the show today, actually. Jess is with us from Gallier House CIC and the Martin Gallier Project, and we're going to be hearing about the work that Jess has been involved in, an incredible amount of work that she's been up to, and also the plans for the future as well. There's plenty for people to sort of get their teeth into, and I think it's going to be really eye-opening program today here on Mental Health Monday. Thanks for joining us in the studio, Jess. You lost your dad to suicide, which as a young woman must be an awful experience. At that time, were you able to fully comprehend, if you like, what you were going through, what the family had found itself going through?
Well, yes and no. I'd expected that phone call for a very long time, actually. I saw it coming from a mile off, and people often say, we didn't see it coming, we didn't expect it, it was so out of the blue. I and my family actually did see this coming quite far ahead. It was completely out of our control. We didn't have the education to do anything with that information. It's not something that you can ever really come to terms with. It's what you do afterwards that I think is so important. So I knew that this experience was either going to break me or it was going to make me, and I made that conscious choice to do something with the experience and to do something with the information that I'd unfortunately seen.
Well, I was going to say, because the time frame we're talking about here is a short one. So we're talking the start of 2017 as we have the conversation now, right in the middle of 2019. So a lot of your emotional sort of reaction to it, does it still feel pretty fresh?
Sometimes. Sometimes it feels fresh. Sometimes it feels like I'm watching something on the telly and this is somebody else's life and this has happened to somebody else, and I'm just someone that's witnessed that. And then I do have these kind of sobering moments when I realise, oh my goodness, this is me, this is my life, this has happened to me and my family. And as time goes on, obviously we all know there's no timeline on grief, there's no limit on how long you can grieve, but as time goes on, those moments get less and less, and it becomes easier to deal with. It's not something that you get over, but it becomes easier to grow around.
How soon did you become aware of the stigma that
straight
can come
away
around
straight
suicide?
Instantly. I got the phone call at 12:36 and that stigma kicked in at 12:37. It was instant.
From yourself or from the reaction that you got?
The reaction I got. I was actually sat in a busy city centre restaurant when I got that phone call. That phone call I'd been waiting for, that phone call that turned my whole world upside down. And obviously I had a group of people around me, and I said what had happened. And even the response within that small group was really varied and really mixed. There were people that didn't want to talk about it, people that wanted to shut off, people that wanted to go to the bar and buy me a drink so they didn't have to say anything. And that's something that just grew and grew as time went on, really.
I mean, somebody gets bad news, is how you react, and people don't always know or are socially sort of equipped to deal in that situation. Do you think specifically because it was a suicide issue that people just thought, I have no idea what to say in this circumstance?
Yeah, I think people are terrified of the word for a start, and I think people shy away from things that they don't know a lot about. I think the one that really hit me was the following day. So my mum said, go and do something very, very normal. So I went to Asda with I was only 3 months postnatal at this point, so my baby was very young. So we went to Asda and I was just kind of wandering aimlessly down the frozen aisle, and I broke down in tears. And this lady, an older lady, came over and said, oh, darling, what's wrong? You're crying. And I said, oh, my dad died yesterday. And it was just one of those horrible moments. And she said, oh, no, what did he die from? And because obviously I was quite young, I was only 26. So there was obviously a story there. So she asked that question. And I said, oh, it was suicide. He killed himself. And instantly, before the words had finished coming out of my mouth, she said, oh, have you seen the weather today? Isn't it lovely outside? Look at the weather. And because she just did not know how to be around that word, how to be around that topic. People don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, it's one of them, isn't it? Because you think that woman was trying to reach out to somebody and probably wanted to say or do the right thing at that moment.
Absolutely.
But then that word, suicide, has obviously completely thrown her to the point she thought, I literally changed the subject.
Yeah.
Was there something in particular you were looking for? Was it simple reassurance, you know, a condolence, a hug maybe?
I don't know. I think I had to say that word out loud to another human being that wasn't a family member, wasn't someone from the hospital, wasn't someone in the situation. I needed to say that word out loud and actually acknowledge what had gone on. I needed to bring him back down to earth, really. And the way she changed the topic so quickly just really stuck in my mind. And it was the first time, really, I'd ever come across a stigma so strong. And it was then that I thought, wow, this is much bigger than me. This is massive.
In regard to that as well, because if people die from heart attacks and cancer, and there's, I think we've almost built in like a social response to that, isn't it? Which is like I'm sorry to hear that. Whereas it does seem strange that we just don't have that.
No. I often wonder if I'd said to her, oh, he had a heart attack, I'm sure she would have said, oh, that's so tragic. How old was he? Or something like that. But the minute the word suicide came out of my mouth, she could not be further away from me.
In regard to how things then play out within your social group, the friends who you've been with on the day, did they almost have to get educated themselves in the way that you became educated in it?
Pretty much, yeah. So I actually lost a lot of friends after my dad's suicide, and that's something that it took me a long time to deal with, but I'm fine with that now. I lost a lot of people that didn't know how to deal with me. I'd always been a very happy, upbeat, outgoing person, and I was suddenly this person that was crying all the time, and I did lose a lot of friends. And so the people that wanted to stick around and wanted to be in my friendship group educated themselves, really, and they're people that are still a massive part of the organisation now and have been a massive part of my healing. But a lot of people made that conscious choice to just walk away.
Which is a real shame.
It's sad. It's very sad.
And again, it's that around that idea that if they knew how to cope, or if we as a society knew how to deal with this situation, we could have drawn on that education or whatever you want to call it to then help you along the route, instead of just thinking, you know what, I can't cope in that situation, so I may as well back out of it completely.
Yeah, I have family members that still won't admit that it was a suicide. You know, it's not just friendship group and wider society. It happens within people's families, and there's people, especially the older generation, that will deny that a relative has died by suicide forevermore. They will just never talk about it, and that's dangerous. It's dangerous for the stigma, and it's dangerous for them.
Do you get a sense, or have you worked out in your own mind why you think that's the case?
I haven't got a clue, and it's bigger than me, and it's not something I think I'll ever know the answer to. I mean, suicide was it was an offence until 1961, but come on, we're in 2019. We're a really long way on from 1961. So I just don't know why this stigma is still rife.
And unfortunately, it's something which is so common.
So common.
As well, for something to be so out in the open, and we can highlight even celebrities who've lost their life by suicide, even within the last 12 months, and people still see it as a, oh, is it something that we can talk about it? Well, if we're not talking about it, then what are we talking about? And if we're not talking about it, what sort of damage is done as well to those people who are here, survivors, if you like, of suicide as well, who then feel like they're sort of curtailed in being able to have a conversation because nobody else fully understands. That's why you wanted to do something with this, and you set up the CIC, Community Interest Company.
That's right.
Gallia House, and it falls under the Martin Gallia Project.
That's right,
as well. At what point did you think, you know what, let's do something, actually put something down with a name and a social media account and, you know, an actual brand, if you like, turning it into something that can be out there in the community?
I can remember the very moment that I decided I was going to do this. So my dad's inquest, and not a lot of people know about inquests and how they pan out, but they're really damaging to families. And my dad's inquest lasted, it was about 9 months. We had about four or five hearings, and we didn't actually get the legal funding to be represented. we had some legal funding to help with all the casework, and Brodie Jackson Cancer picked that up and they were brilliant. But we actually had to do a lot of the legwork ourselves, and we got full disclosure of documents from all the different organisations that my dad was involved with prior to his death, including the police and the probation service and stuff like that. And we went through those with a very fine tooth comb and a highlighter pen, and we really picked up and saw where these gaps were and these little times where, you know, opening times, waiting lists, things like that, where the family, if the family had had a better education, they could have been that little safety net, that little support network, just to see that person through, you know, to the Monday or to the morning or, you know, whatever that might be, whatever those gaps in provision were. And it was the last day of the inquest, the last hearing, where we actually had the conclusion overruled. So it was originally recorded as an alcohol-related death because there wasn't enough evidence to prove that it was a suicide, because that threshold is so high, that burden of proof is really, really high. So we proved that over the 9 months through all these records and stuff, that there were agencies aware of his suicidal thoughts and his plans. And it was the minute that the coroner said, actually, I will rule this as a suicide, and you know, that's it. And this light bulb just kind of went on above my head, and I thought, I've seen too much, I know too much, I can't unsee it, and I feel responsible now. I feel like I need to do something with this information. I could walk away and leave it, and, you know, kind of let it be something terrible that happened in my life, or I can take that really horrible experience that we were forced into, and I can do something with that information, and I can do it in my dad's memory.
In regard to that, there might be people who either listen to this program, certainly people who've been on the program, Jesse, would say, well, that, all those gaps are so huge, and that's based around all those different interventions you might have through doctors, through local counselling services and various other things, that the gap seems too big, the job is too big. How can just Jess on her own deal with this situation? Was there something, one specific thing that you had in mind? You thought, well, if I can provide that, then that bit makes the difference and would have made the difference in my dad's case.
So here's the idea. The idea isn't that Jess comes along in a cape and saves everybody. The idea is that Jess and the incredible team of volunteers that she's got behind her come along and educate the community and spread that education through the community, so the community can start to help themselves. So, for example, our community of New Ferry, which we're not limited to, we'll cover all of the Northwest. Our community of New Ferry is probably the safest street to walk down in Merseyside, if not in Britain. You come out of the train station, Bebbington train station, and straight away you walk past a coffee shop. We've got somebody trained within that coffee shop to deliver suicide first aid. Then you'll see my house. Obviously, I'm there all the time when I'm not at work. And then you'll see a couple of doors down, somebody else that's trained suicide first aid. Then you'll walk down the precinct in New Ferry, and you've got a hairdresser that can, you know, that's there trained in suicide first aid. And then you get to the end of that street, and that's where we are. That's where the Martin Gallier project is. So if you're feeling suicidal, it's probably the safest street to walk down in Britain, but we don't want that to be just our street that's safe. We want that to be every street that's safe. And I suppose the idea is, if we can deliver this training to family members of people that are at high risk, for one, but members of the community, key members of the community, hairdressers, tattoo artists, coffee shop workers, bartenders, taxi drivers, the people that are coming across people all day, every day, we can just make those suicide safer communities.
What for you is the difference then on that street? Those individuals have had the training.
Mm-hmm.
So for you now, what experience might somebody have if they were experiencing those thoughts on that particular street, in a way that they might not get the same experience on a different street?
Okay, so for example, you're walking down the street. Okay, you go to the hairdressers. You go to the hairdressers, and your hairdresser happens to be in that street. You sit down. Everyone tells the hairdresser everything. You sat there for like 3 hours, 4 hours. You tell them about your financial problems, your relationship breakdown, how annoying your husband is. That's what people do in the hairdressers. So you walk into a hairdresser's in our street, you sit down and you tell, you know, tell those stories and have those conversations. And that hairdresser has got it on her radar to ask a very clear, concise question about whether you're considering suicide, whether suicide is actually an option for you. Now, we're missing these people. We're missing these people that are feeling suicidal within our communities, because we're not asking that very clear question. And I'm not talking about beating around the bush and saying something ridiculous like, you're not thinking of doing something stupid, are you? I'm talking about asking a really clear question. Is suicide an option for you? Are you considering suicide? And if you are, what's your plan? What does that look like? How can we disable it safely? So you're not going to get that kind of service in a coffee shop somewhere else, or in a hairdresser somewhere else. And we just want every community to look like that.
And essentially, it's the mental health equivalent of somebody dealing with a critical physical injury.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're doing it from a mental health point of view as well. Suicide first aid. Now, you've been working on funding for this one as well. So this is, let me get this right, ASSIST, the Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training.
Well done.
And you've been training people to have that skill set. Is that something that you're going to sort of make a big focus of the project, if you like, if getting that training out, that specific training out into the community?
Yeah, so our biggest focus for 2019 is to deliver that training. This is what we got the lottery money for, to deliver that training to people that we've identified in our community as being at much higher risk. So that's people that have previously attempted suicide. We'll train up the husband or the wife or the parents or the daughter, whoever it is, we'll train that person up so that when those thoughts come back and that becomes an option again, they're ready to be preventative and pick up on the early warning signs rather than dealing with a crisis. And then our big focus for going into 2020 is those community members. So those people, like we say, coffee shop workers, bartenders, taxi drivers, hairdressers, and to just kind of spread this model that we've got now in New Ferry, spread that, you know, through the Wirral and through Merseyside and then through the North West.
How keen are you to sort of engage with people who, and we talk about, you know, suicidal thoughts being at the end of one particular journey. How keen are you to sort of engage with people who aren't as far down that journey, people who are concerned about their own mental health or a loved one's mental health, that maybe the situation hasn't got anywhere near the idea of suicidal thoughts, but a sense that maybe something isn't quite right and maybe there's action they need to take?
I see that as a massive opportunity, because with a lot of services, you have to hit that crisis point before you can engage, before you can, you know, hit that threshold. We'll deal with anybody. We'll support anybody, regardless of whether they're in crisis or not, whether they just want some advice or, you know, some support. So if we can get them early on, if we can make it so it's standard that every family has a member in there that is, you know, on the lookout for these very, very early warning signs, if we can stop people from getting to that crisis point, surely we're in a better position.
For people who see the building and the project, Jess, what is it physically? What does it look like?
So it's completely non-clinical. It's very flowery and pretty, actually. It's a lovely space. There's nothing sad about the space. All of our volunteers are either bereaved by suicide or have suffered with their own mental health. So you'll always get a lovely warm welcome. The kettle's always on. There's always a packet of biscuits. And it's just there's comfy couches. There's no kind of counselling chairs or, you know, mental health suites or anything like that. It's a very, very nice place, actually, if I say so myself.
You're working on this thing called Man Cave Monday.
Yes.
It's good, isn't it, to do something with the day of the week that begins with an M?
I think so.
Lots of different things come up.
But everything goes on a Monday now because everything starts with an M. So all of our activities are on a Monday.
Well, it's a good way to start the week, isn't it? Focuses the mind right at the start of the week. Tell us about Man Cave Mondays.
So the Man Cave has been set up by one of our volunteers. He's actually a superstar volunteer. He's incredible, Gary. Gary lost his sister-in-law to suicide last year, and he contacted me and said, oh, can I get involved? What can I do? And he wanted to volunteer to do DIY stuff, and now he does absolutely everything. He's brilliant. So he set that up. We are doing a lot of work with Merseyside Police and their early intervention team about what we can do for men within our community, and this is one of the things we've decided to do. So it's a really informal group on a Monday evening from 6:30. We've got some games consoles set up and a telly and just normal things. And it's not going to be a sit round in a circle with chairs in a circle type group. It's a place where men can come, socialise, have a chat with each other and, you know, build that support network that isn't necessarily in a pub or in a bookies. We find a lot of retired men struggle once they've not got that daily banter with the lads. They feel very isolated and very, very lonely. So stuff like this is incredible for them. And it's brilliant for young men as well, young men that are perhaps struggling and don't feel like they can open up to their friendship group because of the stigma.
Yeah, and in regard to that, when you've not got, a big banner that says, you know, this is a suicide prevention centre, it's really a space where people can come together, get involved in DIY stuff or get involved in video games or watching a bit of TV with your mates or people of a similar background to you. That does absolutely normalise it. And really, that just shows that maybe those community spaces, those community offerings can have a hugely positive impact without ever having to focus on, you know, suicidal thoughts or even deal with them, because what you're doing is you're creating an environment where people can have a positive experience.
Exactly. We were just really keen to create this safe place, really, a safe and welcoming, comfortable place. And it has become that place. And if those disclosures of suicidal thoughts come from that, then, you know, brilliant that we've heard it, we're able to deal with it. But 9 times out of 10, it doesn't get to that point because it's so preventative. And we'll have the door open all day. On a day like today when it's sunny, the front door is wide open. And we find people come in, not because they're in crisis or because they need anything, but because they fancy a brew and a chat and to see what we've been up to all week and to see, you know, what we've got going on. It's not that people come to us every single day in a crisis. We try and get people a lot earlier than that.
I almost get a sense, and because I've spoken to a number of people who organise similar types of things around the region, they're within communities, and I don't know if this is down to cuts that have taken place within communities, mm-hmm. there is a demand for that very experience that you've just described. That demand that I just want somewhere where I can go and interact with a human being and have a conversation like I'm a normal, happy, proper person that I want to be with other people in the same situation. And you've tapped into it, and you found it through the work you've done, obviously, mm-hmm. off the back of the suicide that impacted your family. But you found actually something which is actually very human in all of us, just that need to be together and have an opportunity to talk.
Well, we all like to chat, don't we? And unfortunately, I sound like I'm about 86 when I say this, but unfortunately, you can't even go to the bank and have a conversation with someone anymore. Everything's done over the phone or on the internet, or you don't have as many conversations with people on a daily basis, I don't think, with technology. And that's something that I think we all miss. I definitely miss that kind of interaction. And I go into Aldi across the road from my house and I make friends with everybody and I know everyone on first name terms. I can't help myself because that's the kind of person I am. But not everybody's that outgoing. Not everybody's willing to kind of just talk to strangers. And I think as a society, that's having a massive impact on us and our mental health.
Yeah, we've got a strange relationship, haven't we, with other people. Like if you go and sit next to somebody on a bus and start having a conversation, they then start tweeting, why is it the weirdo on the bus always comes and sits next to me? Like you can't, like you say, that those conversations, those normal conversations with butchers or somebody behind, you know, who know all your business, you know, even at a school gate, people are, you know, dropping in and off and, you know, after school clubs, preschool clubs, and it's out the gate and then through the door in the car and everybody's home. Yeah. And actually just those moments of just going, all right, well, can we just all get together and have a chat?
Mm-hmm.
But that's about community cohesion as much as anything, and the Wirral New Ferry will be so much better the place if more of those sort of places existed.
Yeah, I mean, it's not profound, is it? It's really simple stuff, and everything we do is actually very simple.
Yeah,
we've forgotten how to do it. We've forgotten how to have a conversation, and I'll walk down the street and say good morning to everyone in the street, and people look at me like I'm crazy because I'm saying hello. But, you know, go back 50 years, everybody did that. Like my grandparents' age, they all say hello to each other in the street. It's lovely. And we just seem to have lost that as a society, I think.
You've been nominated for the Merseyside Women of the Year and people can vote for you. I'm going to tell people how to vote. Now, please do bear in mind that there are great nominees out there and you can read through them all and decide who you want to vote for, but you can only vote once.
You can only vote once.
We've got Claire Milford Haven. She's coming on the programme very soon. Laura Hughes, who used to work here, she's been nominated as well. But if I scroll, let me just say about halfway down, there it is, Jessica Gallia. See, as soon as I've said, during the break, Jess said, you keep getting my name right. And then ever since that moment, I've got it wrong. MerseysideWomenOfTheYear.co.uk is the website. MerseysideWomenOfTheYear.co.uk. You can hear from the organisers, actually, of the awards on tomorrow's programme. But you can vote on there, read up on all the finalists. And if you see fit, vote for whoever you want to win. Jess's story is on there as well. There's a vote button you can click on there. Remember, you can only vote once. And I think it's until the 10th of June the voting is open for. What would it mean if you won?
I don't think I'm going to win because there's some incredible women. There's honestly some incredible women on there if you read some of the stories. It's just such an honour to be nominated. And I mean, we don't do this kind of work to be recognised and to be noticed, but it is nice. It's like a little cherry on the cake, and it is nice to be recognised, and it does give us a bit of a push to say, you know, carry on, girls. You're doing a really good job. Keep going.
You're based on Newchester Road in New Ferry as well. In terms of where the project can go and what Gallia House can do, is there, we talked about what you want to do 19 mm-hmm. through 2020, where do you see 2025, 2030 and beyond as well? Because the work you're doing, particularly with the suicide intervention skills training,
mm-hmm.
There is something to be said of, you know, nationally people could be taught about this.
Absolutely, and it's really important for us to have, wherever we operate, a little hub, even if it's a small space. And I mean, people laugh at me when I say this, but people always also laughed at me when I took on, you know, the coroner and asked her to change her decision. And people laughed at me when I said I was going to open Wirral's first and only suicide prevention centre. So I can't wait to prove these people wrong like I have with those. I want five. By 2024, I want five centres around the country. And then I want that to continue to snowball.
And that's an ambitious target. You've obviously thought about it. It's obviously something that you've got in mind as well. Tell us about the funding you've got so far. You mentioned lottery funding before.
Yeah, so we had £10,000 from the lottery, and that was to train up the family members of somebody that's previously attempted suicide, and to open the centre. And so that's why we did that on such a budget. We painted it all ourselves, which was great. And then we had £1,000 from the New Ferry Town team to be able to set up in the area and to send us on our training. Our training actually cost us about £6,000, and I'd say about 90% of that we raised within New Ferry itself, which was incredible. We had £1,000 from the ACC Liverpool, and we've got a couple of bids in at the moment, so watch this space.
Brilliant stuff.
Yeah, we don't receive any government funding at all, so we fundraise all the time. So, I mean, if you go on our social media, you'll see me asking for stuff all the time to fundraise.
And if people want to get a sense of sort of how the community sort of bought into the idea of Gallia House, just tell us about how the Warriors were set up.
Oh, so the Gallia Warriors FC, I had this group of young men come to me, wonderful young men came to me and said, we've lost two friends now to suicide, and we'd really like to have a charity match to, you know, to highlight that. Can we raise you some money? And I was like, well, absolutely, you can raise me some money, that would be brilliant. So they had this charity match, and then we had a conversation in the week that followed and said, wouldn't it be brilliant if we could have an actual team and we could send that team around the country to play football matches with a real focus on opening up this conversation about men's mental health? And they said, well, why can't we do that? Let's do that. And I went, okay, let's do that. So we're doing that. We're actually looking for a sponsor for the football team at the moment, which would be great. But yeah, the plan is to go around the country, play these games with just, you know, really banging a drum about men. Come on, talk about it. Let's have a chat about it. There's nothing to be ashamed of. So yeah, if anyone wants a game, that would be brilliant. And if anyone wants to sponsor the team and their kit, that would also be brilliant. They're obviously going to play in red.
Decision was made at 10 o'clock on Saturday night on that one, though.
No, my dad was a big red, and my dad actually always had a joke, because there was five of us kids, and he always used to have this joke that he wanted a football team, I'm going for a football team, and now he has one, so that's lovely.
Absolutely appropriate.
Yeah.
You mentioned the stigma and the reaction in regard to suicide. In the creative sort of setting that you've got now through Gallia House and the volunteers who've had similar projects, you must have very normal conversations, although the grief, I imagine, because it's not, you know, so long ago, less than 2.5 years, is still in many ways very real. Do you have a sort of more normal conversations now about what it's like losing someone to suicide?
Yeah, it's really normalised within our building, and it's pretty much the same as having a cup of tea and a cake. Like, we talk about it like it's the same as talking about the football or talking about the weather. And I think that's what people appreciate so much. So we partnered with SOBS, Survivors of Bereavement by Suicide, to be able to bring a suicide bereavement support group to the Wirral, because there's not actually one SOBS group there at the moment. And I think it's when people start coming to that those conversations will open up. But on a daily basis, it's just a very, very normal thing to talk about. And I think that's incredibly healing for the people that have lost someone.
And I think as well, the other thing that I noticed, particularly doing this show, is that when you create those environments, people are warm to those environments.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually been yearning for that, that opportunity to talk in a really normal way. And in many things, the organisation and the setup that you've got there proves that you don't need to have had the experience you had with friends sort of just disappearing, and family members and people in the street, you know, unable to cope. We've had people come on this programme and say, you know, neighbours have crossed over the road so you didn't have to speak to them.
Yeah, they did.
Because, you know, they didn't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
You've created that environment and people can have those conversations, and they're really normal conversations. And that stigma within the walls doesn't exist?
Because suicide is a really normal thing. It's happening all the time. So if we don't talk about it like it's normal and like it's going on, then we're just feeding that stigma every day. And then how does that, what kind of effect does that have on the people that are feeling suicidal? If we're like that about bereavement by suicide, how do these people that are feeling suicidal think that they can come and talk to us about it? They don't. And we all know that people are at much higher risk when they've lost someone to suicide. So it's just about normalising those conversations and making sure they then don't go down that path themselves.
If people want to get involved in Man Cave Monday or just find out more about you, where's the best place to send them?
Best place is probably social media. So the Martin Gallia Project on both Facebook and Instagram. We do Twitter, but I'm not great at Twitter. So I'm going to say Facebook and Instagram. There's the website, galliahouse.co.uk, but the first place that everything goes, including the training and the training dates, is always Facebook and Instagram.
For people who walk up as well to the building itself at 57 Newchester Road, if they stop outside and look and think, do I step through the door? What will be their experience when they step through the door? Just because it might be that people want to go in and aren't sure whether or not they're either welcome or want to go beyond that threshold. I think they call it threshold fear.
Yes, absolutely. We see people kind of teetering around all the time and driving past and driving back and walking past and asking if you've got a light for a cigarette and stuff like that. It's a really comfortable, normal place. And I'm quite a, you know, a chilled out person, and I'm always there. The first thing I do is put the kettle on, whether somebody's crying or not, the kettle's on. You'll probably be greeted by some rubbish 80s music because that's what I like to listen to. It's just a really chilled out place. And we see people every day. We see people in crisis. We see people that are supporting someone in crisis, and we see people that just need a bit of support. And they always leave saying the exact same thing. Thank you so much. I feel like that's a massive weight off my chest and, you know, a massive load off my shoulders. Thank you for letting me offload that onto you, which is worth its weight in gold, isn't it?
Jess, it's an absolute pleasure to get you on the programme. Look forward to hearing about
Thank
how
you.
The work you do continues to grow.
Thanks,
and
mate.
Really looking forward to catching up with you in 2025 and 2030.
We'll do a tour.
Absolutely. Of the five centres, which will be up and running. I know you're really busy as well, so it's been great to get you on the programme. Jess Gallia, Jessica Gallia, who you can vote for as Merseyside Woman of the Year, if you want to. Merseyside Woman, womenoftheyear.co.uk is the website with a link there to all the finalists. That's MerseysideWomenoftheYear.co.uk. And you can hashtag as well the Martin Gallia Project and look for Gallia House CIC. You'll get all the information that you need. Or head down to 57 Newchester Road in New Ferry. Pleasure to get you on the programme.
Thank you very much.
Great to get you on Mental Health Monday from Radio City Talk.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.